For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're in 2 Corinthians. We're in chapter 2 tonight. We've been at this for a few weeks. And again, I think the context for the letter is pretty important. 2 Corinthians is really about healing a damaged relationship. And Paul the Apostle has been interacting with this church in Corinth. There's been misunderstanding. There's been mistrust on the Corinthian side about Paul. And so and actually 2 Corinthians is the fourth letter that he's written to them. And it is really full, I think, of very practical insight into the dynamics of a spiritually dysfunctional group. And it's also pretty helpful, too, in terms of what does it really look like to bring health to a hurting relationship. And that's a theme that kind of weaves its way through 2 Corinthians quite a bit and comes out in a number of passages. So tonight we're going to look at one of those passages, chapter 2, verses 1 to 4, and get into this whole question of what, you know, does it look like to be real in our relationships, especially knowing that dealing with people is always messy, there's always problems involved, and how do we interact with that in a way that really heals, restores relationships, and brings genuine closeness between people. So we're going to be looking at some principles in this passage, and just think about relationships in your life that matter. Relationships with your kids, with your spouse, with close friends, with people that you would like to be close friends with. I think that we'll find that there is application across a very broad spectrum in terms of what Paul's getting at here. Let's take a look. He says, I determined for my own sake that I would not come to you in sorrow again. For if I caused you sorrow by the things that he had written to them, who then makes me glad but the one who I made sorrowful? This is the very thing I wrote to you, so that when I came, I would not have sorrow from those who ought to make me rejoice, having confidence in all of you that my joy would be your joy. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote to you with many tears, not so that you would be made sorrowful, but that you might know the love I have especially for you. So here's an interesting little paragraph here about Paul's relationship with these Corinthians. And I'm asking the question here, what characterizes Paul's relationship with the Corinthians that you can see in this paragraph? What is said or what is implied that really kind of gives us a window into what's going on in Paul's heart as he reflects on these people that he's been involved with now for quite a few years? What do you think? What do you see here that kind of characterizes the nature of Paul's relationship with them? Anybody got a thought on that? He's bothered? Yeah, I think he definitely is. He's really concerned that...
like a father.
Like a father. Boy, you know, that's really interesting. I think that there are kind of paternal elements to it. We'll talk about that. It's a good point, Beth. What else do we see here?
Sounds like he had to discipline or something that they were upset.
Yeah, they're mad at him. And so now the question is, how do we deal with somebody who's mad at you when in your own conscience you realize, I didn't do these people any wrong, but they are stung by what I had to say. Great point. Joe, what do you think?
And he wants to do something about it. He's got this long history with them.
Yeah.
He knows he's brought up some conflict and just ongoing dialogue, and he wants to keep moving forward with just a conversation.
Yes, and so clearly he values this relationship a lot. The whole tone of it, you know, indicates that they're really important to him. Good call. What do you think, Rob?
I guess it looks like up there at the top, he says, I determined for my own sake that I would not come to you in sorrow again. Uh-huh. So apparently he feels the timing's bad to come to them. Thus he writes the letter. Obviously there's wounds there that he feels aren't quite to the point where he could heal them face to face.
Yep, that's right. So he's going to have to deal with this in some ways long distance. We'll talk about why he didn't show up a little bit later. These are good observations, and I want to kind of generalize from some of the things that have been said to talk in terms of some of the principles that we see kind of riveting through this paragraph and through the letter itself about what does it look like to be real in a difficult relationship. And I want to do that by kind of laying out a little bit of a grid here, and it'll become, I think, apparent as we get into it, why this kind of characterizes the relationship Paul has with the Corinthians. On the horizontal axis, there's kind of a continuum between loose bonds with people and close bonds with people. And by bonds, I mean that sense, that feel that you have of connection with another person, that sense that, man, you know, they're under my skin and they're a part of who I am and I'm a part of who they are. And there's a deep connection along those lines versus a loose connection, which would be like, you know, very casual kind of relationship, something that's really nothing at stake pretty much at all in the relationship. Then, so we want to talk about that a little bit. Then we want to talk about the high risk, low risk, the vertical axis, because that's a part of this passage as well. You know, what is being brought to bear in the relationship? In a low risk environment, you don't want to make waves. And there are certainly some contexts in which it would be totally not appropriate to make waves in relationship. But there are other situations where we feel like we ought to risk our relational clout, as it were, our relational capital with this person, because there's something going on in their life that I'm uniquely suited, perhaps, to speak to that, and that I'm going to do that, even though it may be very costly for me to do just that kind of thing. And so we want to talk about the relationship between the sense of closeness that we are able to establish with people and our ability to risk the relationship for the sake of their good, which is clearly what Paul's doing in this passage. And what I want to advocate is the thought that effective, satisfying relationships with other people are possible to develop, to cultivate, to grow in, as the risk level of our interaction with them is met with a deepening of our emotional connection to them. And that, I think, is something that you just see over and over in the way Paul relates to these people. So let's just, for the sake of analytical purposes, describe what we're talking about, and then we'll end up in that upper right quadrant here toward the end of the passage. We talk about a low-risk, low-bond relationship, which would be a distant relationship, a superficial relationship. We might say like a work relationship. You know, you don't think about the person in the cubicle next to you as your intimate buddy, and you are not thinking about, you know, how can I really, you know, come alongside and help that person, you know that I love them and care for them. They're a work associate, and that's just the way it is. And so it's by design, it's a casual relationship. It's appropriate that it's a casual relationship, and you're probably both more than happy that it stay a casual relationship. So in that context, then, your engagement with them is relatively passive. You interact. Why do you interact? Well, you interact over things about work. You only interact, really, when your paths just necessarily cross. You're not really seeking this person out in any way. You're just kind of occupying the same space, doing the same kind of job, and so you got some kind of relationship going. In these kinds of passive relationships, maybe you can speak to this better than I, but my experience has been that in a more or less distant or superficial relationship with another person, especially when you have a number of those going on at the same time, like in a business situation, in an office or something like that, that those relationships tend toward the judgmental end of the spectrum, the negative. What do people sit around and talk about over the coffee break? How great their boss is and what a wonderful woman she is, and how much they really admire her capacity to juggle work and the family life, and how we would like to emulate such a person. Is that what happens in your office? Or is it something a little different? Like what kind of an unreasonable jerk this guy is, and how he's just using us as pawns for his own professional advantage, or whatever. That's the way they tend to go, I think. It would be fair to say. What's the name of that show, that really quirky off-color show? Yeah, Office. My daughter's like really into that. I think it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. But it is fascinating that all the interaction is essentially negative, isn't it? And I think that's basically true of these kinds of relationships. And we're and relatively unmoved by the experience of others. You know, go to a retirement party sometime. You know, I tell you what, ain't nobody want to be at that party. You know, they just don't care. Like, okay, so you're leaving. Good. Some other hot body is going to occupy that seat, and we're going to move on, just as always. That's just the way it is. Now, it's okay, it's normal to have relationships like that. However, the problem is that some people only have relationships like that. And a person like that, with very casual, passive relationships, is a person who's basically a pretty lonely and alienated person. And there's tons of people, maybe even, I don't know what the percentage would be, but a high percentage of people, I would think, live their lives more or less in the quiet desperation of these superficial, casual relationships that at the end of the day, they may wonder to themselves, you know, what difference would it even make if I was occupying this space or not? And it's sort of a drag in that way. So we don't want to be in that quadrant, but let's think about it from the standpoint of a person who's willing to be high risk in their relationship, but with loose bonds, not tight with people. So who am I talking about here? I'm talking about a cop. I'm talking about your junior high school principal. I'm talking about somebody who is basically very forthright. They're very concerned. Their, you know, issues matter to them. Obedience maybe matters to them, things like that. But they don't care about you. I mean, you are just a person to them, like any number of others. And what they're really concerned about is the rule that you may be breaking or your behavior. So they believe, for instance, that they can be direct because they have a clear and, in our context, a biblically informed conscience. That's why Paul can be so direct in his dealings with the Corinthians, because he has this high-risk belief that truth matters, that it's not loving to just idly sit by and watch people destroy their lives when you could bring some truth to bear on their situation. And so because he's convinced that the things that the Bible says about human relationships and such are objectively true, that is, that they really are true for everybody, he's prepared to put it all on the line, which is why he's now writing his fourth letter to these people. He's put it on the line for them to be straightforward and to be direct with them, and that is something that we should value. To be able to square off and look, you know, eye to eye with another person to say, you know, there's an area of your life that I'm concerned about, but I see is just so out of keeping with what I know to be true of a spiritually alive person. And I just want to put this burden on you to consider. There you have it. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it for a while. A person like this is not easily manipulated. You know, so they may lay a nice steaming load of truth on your lap. And you're going to have to somehow handle that, because now it's been given to you. And you may, you know, respond in manipulative strategies. I know none of you would, but maybe people that you know might do this at some point. You know, oh, you just don't understand my situation. And if you really walked in my shoes, you wouldn't be so quick to judge and this kind of thing. You ever heard anything quite like that before? Okay, so you don't listen to your kids. Anyway, people, when they are hearing something that they don't want to hear, immediately move towards manipulation, blame shifting, excusing, things like that. But the person who really has understood the high-risk dimension of relationships is not going to be that easily manipulated, because they realize, you know, that really what matters here is a question of truth and not a question of how does that sit with you. That you're going to have to deal with that. It's not my job to make you deal with this. And so we're able to keep the focus on what's true and on what's needed in the moment. Man, is it a blessing from God to have a person like this in your life who's not going to BS you, who's going to be a straight shooter, and basically is going to tell you what they know that you need to hear. regardless of how it may make you feel. If you don't have relationships like that in your life, you are vulnerable. And the reality is that this is the way God speaks to most people most of the time, I think, is through people who are willing to risk on this level, to stand on what's true, and to call you to engage with what's true. A person like this is able to keep the responsibility where it belongs. It's not my job to make you feel good or to make you do what's right, but it is my job to impress upon your conscience and on your thinking that this is a big deal. This is an issue that you need to face in your life. Boy, I really like people like that. However, there is a downside to the loose bonds, high risk person, which is that they usually are viewed as harsh, as judging, as people who often have a low view of others. And I know that because that's something I've struggled with quite a bit in my life, is like, you know, what's wrong with you? Can't you just see that this is true and get it together, for God's sake? Yeah. Come on. It's not that big a deal. Just think it through. Make your decision. And so that's a problem, and it's also a problem of self-righteousness, where a lot of people who are on the loose bonds are not really that deeply connected with people, but they have a high regard for truth. They very often come off very self-righteous and very self-assured, and we may find ourselves actually with such a person feeling very unresponsive to what they have to say. We may feel that that person doesn't really understand me. Or even want to understand me. And to that extent, because you don't sense that compassion, you're like, you're willing to, and maybe even feel justified some way, in basically writing off what they have to say. It would be like going to the dentist, who's going, zzz, 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 and he says, we need to do a couple root canals. And what do you say to that guy? I know that you just like to inflict pain, and what? And that you're going to make your next boat payment from my mouth, right? No, we don't conclude that. We conclude that they really are operating out of our best interest as a medical professional, right? But we don't take that same line of thinking often into our relationships with other people. Do it. That, hey, yeah, they may be inflicting pain. They're telling you things I don't want to hear. It doesn't feel that good to me. But I need to hear it. And so there's a discipline in our own hearts and minds, I think, sometimes, where we have to be able to just sit and take a breath and take it and say, thanks that you stuck your neck out in front of a person like me to say what you know would be not very well received. Now let me tell you why you're wrong. It's different. So we got a responsiveness problem because, I think, of the sense of harshness, the sense of judging. That doesn't really help the person who needs to hear from such a person. Let's move on to the person who's low risk. They're not going to really risk that much of their relationship, but they're very high on the connection, the close bonds. I'm thinking here of Mary Poppins. You know, Mary Poppins, the one who is warm and initiating and accepting and affirming and makes work into a game and you know, is just so approachable, and you just want to be around Mary Poppins, right? Well, let's think about Mary Poppins. You know, she is a person that when you're hurting, you want to be around because they are so approachable, right? That she just kind of oozes this sweet, syrupy, come to me, and I'll make you feel good because, you know, you're so special. Here's a question for you. Okay, because I doubt there are very many Mary Poppinses in our midst. But it does raise this question. Namely, what do people sense from you? What do people sense from you? I had the experience a while back, this has been a couple of years ago now, but probably the same dynamics hold. I was talking to this woman who volunteers in our library over the study center. And I was with my wife and this couple that we were just kind of getting acclimated to our fellowship, showing them around. And I was introducing our friends to the study center and stuff like that. The woman who was volunteering there sees me and she goes, "Is that your wife?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I never put those two things together. Your wife is such a wonderful person. I really like her, but I think you're a real jerk." I'm like, really? I've never even talked to this woman before. I'm thinking, do I send off, you know, jerk vibes or whatever it is? And then I began to realize, my God, you know, there's a lot of people who hold that view of me. Except for they frame it differently. They say, "Oh, you're kind of intimidating." Or, you know, the other kind of language is a little more sanitized, but it's the same kind of thing. Like, basically, I'm an unapproachable person. And that, you know, that did bother me. Not that I've done anything about it, but it does bother me. So anyway, the thing is, our capacity to develop in a relationship with another person is going to be to a very significant degree influenced by what they sense from us. Are we approachable? Are we gracious? Do we have a sympathetic ear and a willingness to understand the real struggles that other people really do have? This type of thing. You know, what do people sense from you? There is an answer to that question. And my guess is the answer that you're formulating in your mind would be much more accurate if you simply engaged the person who's sitting right beside you. And to have some honest conversation about that. What kind of a environment do I establish for a relationship? Am I an inviting person that people enjoy being around and look forward to? Or am I that kind of person like me who people kind of like, "Hey, here he comes, run," you know, this type of thing? Because that's going to matter quite a bit. And we all, you know, find ourselves in this way, and we can make relationships easy or we can make relationships difficult. You know, Mary Poppins is warm and initiating, she's accepting and affirming, and people love to be in her presence. But there's a problem with a person who is good at establishing relational bonds, but is unwilling or not very good at really risking that relational clout in the relationship. They want to keep it warm and affirming and welcoming and all this kind of stuff, and so they will not look at things sometimes that really must be looked at in the life of another person for the sake of their own good. And one of the reasons might be, if you find yourself in this category, which I know many of you are, is that maybe you're not convinced that the relationship needs to be maybe jeopardized a little bit by an infusion of truth. You may lack biblical or defensible convictions, for instance. And so because you want to keep the relationship warm, there are things that you just avoid talking about. Now, what am I talking about here? I'm going to get some specifics, because these are the kinds of, this is where the rubber meets the road type of stuff that I've seen, at least. For instance, when parents talk to their kids about sex. You know, most parents do not want their kids to be sexually active. I don't care what they believe. That's just a fact. Okay? But how many parents have the ability to sit down and talk to their hormonally crazed teenager to explain to them in real, rational, coherent, biblical terms why remaining sexually pure is a good thing? See, there's the problem is that that's where you kind of go, bzz, you know, I don't know. So we'll resort to control instead, you know, and if you're not home, and here's the chastity belt, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so we operate by kind of a fear, threat, legal command system, because we don't really know how to just appeal to them on the basis of what's true and persuade along those lines, not just that we love them, but what we have to say makes sense to them and is for their best interest. A person who's like the person we're describing here, who's high on bond, low on risk, does not know what to say here. And to that extent will imperil their kid. Because they won't, at the end of the day, know, you know, here I'm in a situation that I had not predicted, that I had not thought about. And what am I saying to myself to respond in this situation? If we don't have biblical, defensible, reasonable foundations for why we live our lives the way we do, we are not able to provide that for our kids. And to that extent, they are imperiled. So not being convinced is a real big problem. There's another area, like fretting about financial priorities in marriage. That comes up. I think the number one cause for divorce, the studies show fairly regularly, is an inability to get it together under common assumptions and values relating to money. Indebtedness, income, how much we work, things like that. Those are really big issues, and the person who just doesn't have a framework to understand these things is never able to really resolve those kinds of tensions and is then sometimes really undone by them. And so it's a big deal that a person learn how to be high risk in those relationships, because the reality is that we've got real high risk issues involved in ordinary everyday life. That's just the way reality is. Okay? Let's press it a little further, because these are things that, you know, as we learn and as we engage the Scripture and we interact with other people maybe who've learned some things about that, we can develop in those convictions. But I'm also aware, too, that sometimes we stay in the low-risk quadrant of relationship, not just because of our ignorance of what biblical principles are sometimes, but because we have actually embraced and maybe even defend deeply non-biblical ideas, secular ideas and values. And so I may see another person that I care about, and they're involved in a manner of living that intuitively and instinctively, I think there's something really wrong with that. You know, what they're into, I think that's really damaging and wrong. But then what's the other voice that comes in my head after I've uttered to myself, there's something wrong with this picture? Our culture wants to tell us something too. Well, what matters is that you're happy, whatever that means for you. So of course in our culture we would never enter into a discussion with someone that might be uncomfortable. Because, I mean, how arrogant is that to bring up principles that are just only a matter of opinion anyway and getting all hot and bothered and steamed about stuff like that, when the reality is, at the end of the day, that the only thing matters is what floats your boat. And so, having played that tape in our mind, we realize, oh yeah, what was I getting all upset about anyway? It doesn't matter if they're into this kind of thing, and whatever it does to their life is, of course, their business. Does that sound familiar to you? Are you tempted to think this way? I'm tempted to think this way. And I know you are as well, because we live in a culture that just reinforces this all the time. And so I ask you this question. What would have to be true for that statement to make sense? What would have to be true for the statement, what matters is that you're happy, whatever that means for you? What would have to be true for that sentiment, that idea to be the case, to be true? Have you ever thought about that? What do you think?
That you would have to know exactly what makes you happy.
That's a very interesting point. People think maybe they know what will make them happy, only to realize, in having pursued that direction, that at the end of the rainbow, it didn't make them happy at all.
Yeah, which is not really going to happen. Because, I mean, like, it's happiness is not an actual state of, it's a feeling. It's not a permanent state of being.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? Is she saying that you can't go to the store and buy a game, a board game that has, you know, location happiness that you can, you know, roll your way to? I think you're on to something there. I think one of the reasons why that statement, whatever makes you happy, whatever floats your boat, you know, whatever that means for you, is bankrupt, is because the reality is your flight, you know, you're pursuing something that's so ethereal that you never can land on it. What do you think, Joyce?
I think it's saying that there's no wrong way to be happy.
Okay, good. No wrong. So it's kind of a relativistic thing. It's saying everyone has to decide for themselves what's true or false, right or wrong, desirable, undesirable. And that's the way it is. Well, what's wrong with that point of view?
I think that tends to harm others in a really horrible way. So in a...
Like, what do you mean?
Like, if what made me happy is to berate everyone in this room to a point where you're in tears, and I felt great about that, no one else in this room would be happy. So it's kind of, I mean, going along with what she said,
okay,
there's, it's really relative. I mean, and there's no absolute about it.
Okay, so we haven't, if it's up to whoever the individual is to determine what makes them happy, you could end up with things that make them happy at everybody else's expense. But then you say, well, you know, between consenting adults, or as long as it doesn't harm somebody else or whatever. But then that raises the question, doesn't it? It demands that we answer the question, where does that principle come from that I should never harm another person or the consenting adults or whatever it is that I fill in the blank? Now I'm appealing to some kind of a real standard. An objective standard, saying it's true or false, whether I believe it or not. And now that we no longer accept that basic principle as being true.
I think that ultimately that's a really alienating position, because whatever makes you happy, that makes you happy. Whatever makes me happy, that makes me happy. We don't really know what that is, but there's really no way to connect either. So I think it's ultimately very alienating and isolating and kind of an anarchical
okay.
position.
It's like that song, who sings the song, the storyline is, you know, if it makes you happy, then how come you're so sad? You know, it does have that kind of effect. And we wonder, you know, I'm pursuing what's happiness for me or whatever, and I'm hoping I'm finding it in you. And you're saying at a certain point, no, I think I'm going to find it over there. And so we end up, you know, with a really tortured and screwed up kind of psyche at that point. It's important that we understand that. It's important that we can speak to that within our own minds. One more.
I don't know, but isn't this kind of ignoring what the principles that God set forth for us to kind of look at? I just feel like it's ignoring, you know, what matters.
Yeah.
Means to us,
yeah,
is ignoring him.
That's
altogether.
Right. That's right. We're basically saying, God, I don't believe that you speak to. I know that I believe that you created me uniquely in your image as a personal being, but I don't believe that you're an authority that can be trusted in the area of personal relationships. You know, things like that. Yeah, that's a good point. We need to be able to say some things like this to ourselves. These are the messages that were sent. These things are undermine our moral conviction, our capacity to speak with clarity, to help people in our own lives. And so that's really important that I think we're understanding that. It also occurs to me that people who are low risk and value highly the emotional connection with people tend to be very self-protective. And what do I mean by that? I mean that here's where your classic kind of what in secular literature is called the enabler comes in, that you would rather be manipulated by another person than experience the personal suffering that comes when you discipline them. How many of us, you know, when our kid is bouncing off the wall, do we want to just put earplugs in, you know, and close the door? Versus really engage that child and help them cultivate real self-control and things like that. You know, we are this way oftentimes, and it's because why? It's because why? Let's just dispense with the psychobabble and maybe call it selfishness. Maybe it's my feelings of you know, whatever, calm, peace, pleasure, whatever, are more important than what you need in this moment to get some tools in your life to grow as an individual, as a person. And it's difficult, I know, for many of us. I grew up in a family that was completely dominated by alcohol and narcotic addiction. And, you know, you can see that both with my mother and with my siblings, how people interacted with that would work all the way around the problem and never squarely, like, square off and say, this is the problem, this goes no further. And when you just kind of allow, you know, yourself to be walked over by the abusiveness of another person, it's not loving them. And it gives you maybe a momentary kind of way out, you know, but in the long term, you know, you're damaging yourself as well. And I think that it's very important that when we are looking at another person's behavior and we realize that there are real problems there and we just basically do whatever we can to smooth it over without addressing it, we are not loving them. We're only interested really in protecting ourselves. It's a very narcissistic response to the real problems that people face in life and that God has placed us in their life to help them, you know, work through. It's a big deal. People who live in a long-term relationship with people like this, you know, spouses, parents, close friends, things like that, the reality is, you know, instead of having that sense of real closeness that they value so much, at the expense of what's true for that person and what's in their best interest, you know, they actually end up living in deep resentment of that other person. Deep, bitter resentment of that other person. And it's just really true, I think, that, you know, contrary to the Mary Poppins image of the everything's cool and you're so wonderful and this kind of thing, a person like this, ironically, ends up with very shallow relationships and just oftentimes very miserable kind of individual. And a lot of us, I know, struggle deeply and profoundly in our relationships along these lines. So we've got imbalances in a lot of different ways in terms of our being almost totally disengaged, maybe that lower left quadrant. Maybe we're not engaged with people, but we are going to bludgeon them with the truth. Or maybe we're going to really care about them and woo over them and, you know, emotionally love bomb them or whatever. But we're never going to speak the truth to them. You know, and we are different kinds of people, and we've got different kinds of problems in this area. And I think that there is some help that we can get from this text to move into this right upper right quadrant where we really do have authentic and real bonds with people and that we are willing to put our relationships at risk for the sake of their own good. Let's talk for briefly then about these two areas. What does it mean and what can we learn about cultivating bonds with others from this passage? The first thing is that Paul is very unapologetic and very easy in his capacity to express his love to these people. Look what he says at the end of verse 4. He says, I wrote to you with many tears, not so that you would be made sorrowful, but that you might know the love that I have for you. That you might know the love that I have for you, he says. You know, that's really important. What is he saying? He's saying that it's not enough to simply say, I love this person, but I need to express it in such a way that they know that that's true. That Paul is genuine in his expression of love, and he is expressing it in terms that they understand. Do you see that there's a difference here between loving somebody and loving them in such a way that they know that you love them? There is a difference between those things. Lots of guys
deeply love their wives. But their wives are always wondering, I wonder how he feels about me. And they say when this comes up, maybe, you know, well, I told her I loved her a few years ago. Nothing's changed. You know, or whatever. I took the trash out. What more can she ask? You know, but Paul says, I wrote that you may know that I love you. And how do we make the people in our lives know that we love them? You know, we could spend a whole night or several nights even on this topic. I think it's a really important one. But to love is to communicate, and communication is a receiver-oriented discipline. I don't love those who love me merely, and I don't love people the way I want to be loved merely. I love people in the terms that they understand that they are valued, that they are respected, that they are cared for, and so forth. And that's an obligation that I have in relation to the people that God has brought into my life. Paul says that you may know that I love you. Do people know that you love them? Do they know that? How would you make that evident to them? How would you communicate that to them? You know, it's a big deal. And it's something to really think about. I think in terms of our relationships, it's very helpful sometimes just to sit down when we've got some quiet time to ourselves and just, you know, jot down a handful of really significant, important relationships in our lives, or relationships that we want to see really deepen in a significant way, and say, you know, what would it mean for me to really demonstrate love to this person? How would I do that? You know, and sometimes that means that I'm going to do some things that I'm not naturally drawn to. You know, go out and see some sappy chick flick or something like that. Or, you know, buy these biodegradable products that live for, you know, just a few days, and then they're just trash, you know, flowers. See what I'm saying? You know, those things matter to my wife. She's a horticulturist, you know. They don't matter to me that much. But if I want to love her, I'm going to do things that she connects with. And I need to think about lots of relationships along those lines, and you need to do that. If you want to influence people, you better know how they understand love, you know, the communication of love. He goes on, you know, I think there's another element here in terms of cultivating really real bonds with people. There is this element of compassion that Paul describes as well. Look what he says in verse 4. He says, out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote to you with many tears. And compassion is that ability to be moved personally by the struggles and the suffering of another person. And I think, you know, we are busy people. We are people whose souls are full of our concerns. And compassion is the capacity to find space in our soul to feel the suffering of others. And we, if we are going to have bonds with people that are transformative, we need to find space in our hearts to be moved by the experience of other people. That's the only way it happens. I was thinking about that Friday night. My wife and I got together with some old friends, close friends, friends who have experienced a fair amount of suffering in their life. And it was kind of interesting because as the hours went on and our discussion continued, you know, like the mature people they are, the conversation moved off of them and onto us and some of the critical things in my wife Linda's in my life that are, you know, really hard for us. And I had my glasses off. We were talking, and I remember looking up, and, you know, the wife is, her face is red and her eyes are
welled up with tears, and I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, what is that? That's a person who's created space in her soul for the suffering that we experience. And there's a connection that happens when we're like that. So thanks, Mary. That was really sweet. Then we want to also talk about what does it mean to cultivate risk in our relationship. And Paul speaks of that too in a couple of ways in this paragraph. It's this idea of Paul speaks with great conviction, as we talked about last week, and great confidence. Look what he says in verse 1. He says, I determined for my own sake that I would not come to you in sorrow again. I was determined, he said. And there's just this resoluteness in his voice as he writes this letter to them. He knows that they had decisions that they needed to make and they needed to be clear on as a body before it would be profitable for him to come and be with them and have some real reconciliation in their relationship. They had to own some real important convictions. And, you know, we need to be convinced. And are we convinced that our Creator knows us better than we know ourselves? That as He calls upon us to trust Him in important areas of our lives, that He is trustworthy, that He speaks truth. And are we convinced that in understanding these truths, that it is love that draws us to without ambiguity and eye to eye and with real conviction, call upon a loved one in our lives to obey in this important area of life for their own good? And we live in a convictionless culture. And we live in a culture where we're taught to resonate with the feelings of others. And I think there's some value in that. But not at the expense of a community of people who are prepared to call each other to spiritual reality based upon clear biblical truth, clear biblical instruction. That's what we need. And Paul was not afraid to call the Corinthians to real truth in this area. Godly confidence. Look what he says. This is at the end of verse 3. He says, having confidence in you. I have confidence in you, he says. And then he goes on and says, that my joy would be your joy. That's very interesting, too, in terms of learning and cultivating the capacity for risk in relationship. It is not just a matter of being confident that what we believe is true is really true, but he expresses confidence in them, doesn't he? Notice the total lack of cynicism about this group. You know, the Corinthians were a really screwed up group of people. They're even more screwed up than us. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but it's true. We talked about this when we started our study of this letter. You know, here they thought what would be a really cool way to celebrate communion is to show up and get liquored, get drunk on the communion wine, you know. Then we'll have a real, you know, deep contact with God, a real spiritual experience. You know, they had, as we'll talk about next week, a guy who was in an incestuous relationship with his mother. You know, there's some really creepy, weird stuff about this group. It would be the kind of group that I would say, oh, man, am I glad I'm beyond them, you know, and never have to go back to that place. And beyond that, they even get mad at me when I say there might be a problem in these areas. So that, forget it. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, right? I've said what needs to be said, so the hell with you. You know, but Paul is not like that. And there is just a fundamental absence of cynicism as Paul expresses real hope for these people. And are we able to have that same sort of confidence that God's at work in this person's life? Maybe contrary to the immediate, maybe contrary to what I've been seeing lately, that there is still a God who is alive in that person's life, that he is at work in their lives, that he wants them to embrace what he's bringing on them, you know, some correction or whatever, way more than we do, and that he's also a whole lot more persuasive than I am. And can we be confident in a God who is active in this way in other people's lives? If we don't have that kind of confidence, then basically what we're saying is the best way that this person is going to experience change in their life is through, you know, the used car salesman tactics of a persuasive person. You know what? That's not very persuasive. But if we believe that there is that other voice in their hearts that we don't have access to, the Spirit of God saying, what he's saying really is true. You can ignore him, but you can't run from the reality of what he's talking about. You know, we have a God that's like that. And so Paul can express confidence. And for that reason then, can look to the future with a sense of joy. And as we were talking about that with our friends on Friday, that point came back again, you know. We don't have to rest our hopes and a sense of joy in the present, in the resources of the now, but in a God who is capable of bringing these things to pass. Thanks, Harry. So let's wrap things up here. Let's spend some time in prayer. Lord, we thank you so much that it is possible to have reality in our relationships. We thank you that, you know, your word just over and over, either by description or by how it instructs us or whatever, we get this message, God, that you're calling on us to, you know, really connect on a deep level with people. Because, you know, that's really how love is communicated. That's what it means to be personal. And I pray, God, for the many people here tonight who, like me, find this particularly difficult, that we would learn what does it mean to establish deep, close bonds with many people, and that with that, Lord, we would also take our growing knowledge of your word and what you're about and bring those truths into our observations and into our relationship with other people. Knowing, God, that truth is not just some abstract thing that, you know, is cool to agree with or whatever, but it really is, you know, it determines the course of people's lives. And so I pray that you'd give us a high level of confidence that when you speak with both authority and clarity and real compassion for people, and that you're calling on us to do the same. Lord, help our relationships become so real that people from the outside who see these relationships happening realize, as the word describes, that, you know, you're alive, that there's something unusual going on. Help us, Lord, in short, to be people who are lovers like you're a lover. And so just thanks for this chance to be together and for our fellowship here tonight. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.